right. It is Thursday. It is the 9th of April, 2026, and it is time to begin the reading of today's Wall Street Journal. With the Wall Street Journal on this Thursday, we say hello to Ken.
Hello and welcome. Peace deal sends stocks up, drives oil into a sharp drop. A historic plunge in oil prices, a soaring stock market, a treasury rally. They all arrived Wednesday despite missiles and drones continuing to fly across the Middle East. For weeks, pressure has built on Wall Street for a post-war rally that no one wanted to miss. Stock pickers hung on President Trump's every word for signs of de-escalation. Shorts on crude futures and energy stocks piled up. The U.S. and Israeli ceasefire with Iran on Wednesday kicked many of those trades into high gear, even as the outlook for skyscraper-sized tankers of oil and gas transiting one of the world's energy choke points remains unclear. Excuse me. As traders sent crude futures to one of their largest one-day drops on record, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 2.8%, or around 1,325 points, logging its best day since April 9, 2025. There was a kind of pent-up demand for a modicum of good news, said Phil Blanco, chief market strategist at ASIC. Investors on Wednesday didn't wait for signs of whether the ceasefire will hold or if shift traffic through the Strait of Hormuz picks up. Benchmark U.S. oil prices plunged 16%, a decline not seen since the depths of the pandemic, to $94.41. At a time, the prices of oil has been a de facto extension of the battlefield between Washington and Iran, as well as a singular force driving financial markets worldwide that was enough to send stocks catapulting from New York to London to Tokyo. It would be foolish to say we're out of the woods, but I think both parties have reasons to stay on the path towards a peaceful resolution, said Chris Ghisanti, chief market strategist at MAI Capital Management. It's always a dangerous thing to say, but I think the worst is behind us. The prospect that the largest oil supply disruption in history could soon ease propelled the S&P 500 2.5% higher, while the NASDAQ composite jumped 2.8%. The gains extended across the globe, with every major European and Asian index logging gains of 2% or more. The surge came almost 1 year to the day since the president paused his Liberation Day tariff proposals that had sent markets tumbling. That bait and switch, and the optimistic bets that Trump-fueled market rout would come to a rapid end, ultimately earned their own moniker, TACO, for Trump always chickens out. Wednesday's taco trade didn't pack as much punch as past pullbacks from tariff on or war ultimatums. But the shift from Trump's threats to a whole civilization will die tonight to a two-week ceasefire deal still momentarily vindicated those who bet the Middle East conflict would be just a short-term drag on markets. Economically sensitive industrial and consumer discretionary stocks jumped, as did home improvement stores and even risky artificial intelligence plays. Flash memory maker SanDisk Corp. rose 9.9%, while shares of United Airlines climbed 7.9%. Chock full of fuel-hungry companies, including trucking firms and rail operators, the Dow Jones and Transportation Average notched a record. The flip side was that bets on a wartime commodity shock got hammered, with a sell-off ranging from international major oil companies like ExxonMobil, Texas shale drillers such as Apache, and natural gas exporter Cheniere. Shares of U.S. fertilizer producer CF Industries fell 5.7%. Few are convinced that tumult is over. Tanker tracking firms report that traffic through the Persian Gulf remains at a trickle compared with pre-war levels. It is highly unlikely that trade into the Gulf will simply resume, Neil Roberts, head of marine and aviation at Lloyd's Market Association, which represents Lloyd's of Underwriters, said. At the same time, oil prices remain about 60% higher than at the start of the year, putting pressure on an American economy that was already staring down stubbornly high inflation. The price of oil after the ceasefire announcement has not fallen further, in our view, because fundamentals tend to be sticky and ceasefires tend to be tricky, Clearview Energy Partners told clients. And even before the war, investors had other things to worry about. A fresh bout of AI jitters weighed on shares of software, financial services, and even trucking companies earlier this year. Concerns about the private credit market still linger. The rise in energy prices has already dashed Wall Street's hopes for multiple interest rate cuts this year. On Wednesday, traders saw a 73% chance that the Federal Reserve doesn't cut rates at all in 2026, up from 4% before the start of the conflict, according to CME FedWatch. This is a fragile situation. You cannot ignore that, said Ben Emmons, chief investment officer at FedWatch Advisors. He noted that the CBOE Volatility Index, though it plummeted on Wednesday, still looks relatively elevated. The pricing in the market indicates there's some hedging still required, or a desire to see how this plays out. Mark Hackett, chief market strategist at Nationwide, said some investors remain concerned that Iran is tightening its grip on the Strait of Hormuz and limiting tanker traffic. This isn't as easy as waving a magic wand, Hackett said. Paramount president resigns amid suit. Jeff Shell is resigning as Paramount's president and is stepping down as a board member, the media and entertainment company said Wednesday. Shell's resignation comes after an investigation into whether he disclosed confidential company information to a man who claimed to have consulted for a veteran media executive. Paramount Skydance said its probe cleared him of wrongdoing. Shell was accused of leaking material non-public information about Paramount's business dealings by R.J. Cipriani, a self-professed fixer and whistleblower who said he did work amounting to crisis communication services for Shell. Cipriani alleged in a breach of oral contract and fraud lawsuit filed in March in California Superior Court that he consulted for Shell from August 2024 through February 2026. During that time, the suit alleged, Shell disclosed advance notice of Paramount's deal to acquire UFC media rights valued at $7.7 billion, among other things. Paramount said Shell was resigning to focus on the suit. Cipriani said Shell reneged on a purported promise to make Star Serenade, an English-language version of a Spanish-language music reality series Cipriani and his wife created that airs on the Roku channel. Cipriani filed a similar lawsuit against Paramount and its board. The facts demonstrated that these allegations do not establish a securities law violation, Paramount said Wednesday. Shell notified Paramount of these accusations and is taking forceful legal action, the company said. Paramount and members of its board will respond in the proceedings to the frivolous and baseless claims against them, the company said. Shell has filed a counterclaim against Cipriani, alleging defamation and extortion. Shell's departure from Paramount was expected regardless of the Cipriani squabble, people familiar with the matter said. While he was instrumental in the buildup of Paramount's acquisition of Warner Brothers Discovery, most of the company's key unit leaders reported to Chief Executive David Ellison. Shell's departure from Paramount marks the second time he has left a high-profile position under pressure in recent years. In April 2023, Shell resigned as chief executive of Comcast's NBC Universal after an investigation into a sexual harassment complaint. Shell said at the time he had an inappropriate relationship with a colleague. Cipriani said he had a role in publicizing the circumstances of Shell's departure from NBC Universal, saying in his complaint that it was consistent with his long-standing practice of exposing misconduct in the entertainment and media industries. Oil CEOs have profited during the Iran conflict. President Trump's bombing campaign against Iran is yielding a windfall for some of America's top oil executives. Executives sold stock valued at $1.4 billion in the first quarter of the year as the share prices of Chevron, ConocoPhillips, Diamondback Energy, and other oil and gas companies soared on the back of a shock to the world's crude supplies, according to an analysis of insider transaction disclosures from analytics firm Verity Data. Some of the sales were prearranged under plans that allow executives to sell stock automatically at specific times or share prices without making in-the-moment decisions that could leave them open to allegations of improper trading. The plans are often set weeks or months in advance, though the specifics are rarely public. Nonetheless, the executive's timing was auspicious. Chevron chief executive Mike Wirth sold shares valued at $104 million between January and March. ConocoPhillips' Ryan Lance netted about $54.3 million in share sales in March alone. Lorenzo Simonoli, CEO of oil field services company Baker Hughes, sold $33 million of stock that same month. The sales might prove prescient. The prospect of a ceasefire between the U.S. and Iran drove oil prices and energy stocks lower Wednesday as traders anticipated at least a temporary respite for markets. Last quarter's energy sector insider sales reflected a mix of trades determined by prearranged trading plans as well as ad hoc sales. Both give investors insights into executives' sense of where their sector might be headed. It speaks to the opportunistic behavior of everyone involved. It could be opportunistic set months earlier. It could be opportunistic in the moment, said Ben Silverman, research head at Verity Data. The sales hit a 15-year peak, with nearly six executives selling for every one that bought shares in the first quarter, well over double the usual ratio, according to Verity Data. By contrast, buyers and sellers were roughly matched in the same quarter last year. Insiders bought just $29.5 million in shares in this year's first quarter. There was a breathlessness to the selling, and the message they sent was to cash in now because the ride won't last forever, Silverman wrote. Executives sold at companies in every part of the energy sector. At nearly a dozen companies, the number of executives selling in the quarter reached or surpassed 10-year records, and in some cases set new records, Verity Data said. CEOs stood out as big sellers in many cases. Verity Data found, with details suggesting at least some of them had little confidence the rally would last, selling shares not linked to stock option exercises, switching from buying to selling, harvesting minimal gains on outstanding options, and selling at the tail end of a trading window. Companies typically restrict insider sales shortly before a financial quarter ends. These are not routine transactions. They are deviations that signal conviction, Silverman wrote. If conflict in the Middle East keeps Brent crude prices over $100 a barrel, energy stocks might stay high or rise, he noted. But insiders are questioning whether current valuations are sustainable. Federal forecasters at the Energy Information Administration expect that Brent will average around $70 a barrel by year end, even after accounting for the war. Much of the selling for the first quarter began before the U.S. and Israel began bombing Iran on February 28th, when markets enjoyed ample crude supplies and oil prices lingered around $60 a barrel. Few in the industry could have predicted the U.S.-Israel bombing of Iran and that the same barrels would fetch nearly $120 just a few weeks later. Jeff Miller, CEO of Oilfield Services Company Halliburton, sold shares in January under a trading plan at a price of $34.96, giving him a meager 11% return on options with as much as 3 years to expiration, Verity Data found. The stock hit $40.42 in late March. Chevron's Wirth made his largest ever sale January 5th, triggered automatically by a rise in the company's share price 2 days after the U.S. removed Venezuela President Nicolas Maduro from office. Chevron is the only active U.S. oil producer in the South American company. Wirth's sales plan triggered at a share price of around $165 and generated $52.3 million, nearly 44% of his career pre-tax proceeds. Wirth's trading plan was set in November 2024. The rising share price also prompted a sale for the company's finance chief, Amir Bonner. She sold shares from exercising options that wouldn't have expired for another 4 to 9 years, reaping 15% gains. Then, in March, Wirth sold stocks valued at an additional $51.6 million. The bulk of that sale was triggered under a November 2025 plan, securities filing show, but a $17.2 million chunk wasn't linked to a trading plan. The sales, which totaled $104 million, are equivalent to four times Wirth's 2025 reported compensation of $26.8 million. Wirth still owns 68,000 shares, according to FactSet. Shares of Chevron, the second largest U.S. oil company after ExxonMobil, have climbed more than 50% since Wirth became CEO in 2018. The stock's biggest increases in that time came during the 2022 energy crisis following Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the global shock. It opened Wednesday at $191.41. Executives at other companies have also raked in millions of dollars thanks to price gyrations. Some of the sales by Lance at ConocoPhillips occurred when his company's stock price hovered at a near-record high of about $132 in late March. The windfall accounted for about 30% of the share proceeds Lance has collected since May 2009, according to Verity Data. Travis Stice, executive chairman of Perryman Driller Diamondback, sold $18.1 million in shares on March 6th, his largest sale ever, Verity Data said. Baker Hughes Simonelli made the $33 million sale as part of a predetermined trade that was put in place in November 2025. Executives at Cheniere Energy, the largest U.S. natural gas exporter, have also benefited. In late March, Chief Commercial Officer Anatole Feygin sold $11.8 million of stock, only his third sale since joining the company in 2014. Oil stocks and oil prices could be down on headlines, said Kevin McCurdy, director of research at financial services firm Pickering Energy Partners, but fundamentally, it is a strong picture looking 6 months, a year out. AI giants try charm offensive to soothe the public backlash. Artificial intelligence companies appear to be organizing around a simple message in the face of rising public anxiety about the negative potential effects of their world-changing technology. We come in peace. OpenAI this week published a populist wish list of policy proposals that zeroes in on worries like job replacement and wealth concentration, floating such ideas as a foundry work week and an AI-invested public wealth fund distributed to citizens. Those proposals come as its rival, Anthropic, has been signing partnerships and building tools for such sectors as consulting and software, where share prices have been whacked by investor worries that they will be replaced by AI. Anthropic's efforts have helped push up shares of tech companies, including LegalZoom.com. Anthropic and OpenAI are each pursuing ventures to help private equity, a big owner of companies in sectors ripe for disruption, with AI transformation. Those efforts could also yield lucrative new business customers. Call it confidence building for the AI era. The biggest AI companies for a long time amassed marketing mileage and new customers by touting the nearly godlike transformational potential of their tools. The dangers they talked about felt like far-off science fiction. Excuse me. Now, as some businesses, investors, and individuals become more concerned about who will be swamped in that transformation, the companies are making a pivot to trying to help manage the downside. We do feel an urgency to this conversation, Chris Lehane, OpenAI's chief global affairs officer, told the Wall Street Journal recently. Some business leaders have started warning that AI disruption might come faster than society can adjust. There's a real risk artificial intelligence could widen wealth inequality, BlackRock's chief executive officer Larry Fink wrote in his annual shareholder letter in March. An OpenAI spokeswoman said the company is seeking to be proactive in its approach to prompting conversations about AI and its rapid advance. That means coming to the table with real solutions that are transformative as the underlying technology, she said. A handful of recent polls show that the hottest AI labs will have to reassure a wary public. Americans appear profoundly apprehensive about the potential impact of AI on society, with concerns ranging from widespread job losses to broad cybersecurity threats. A March poll from Quinnipiac University found that while AI use is increasing, 55% of Americans believe more harm than good will come from the technology in their daily lives. That is up from 44% in a poll last year. An NBC News poll conducted in late February and early March found that AI had a net favorability rating below that of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. In the past, OpenAI has opposed some policies and candidates seeking to regulate the industry, said Ambakak, a former AI advisor to the Federal Trade Commission. But broad skepticism and fear about the impact of AI have made opposing all regulation untenable for tech company CEOs, said Kak, who is co-executive director of the AI Now Institute, which has advocated for AI regulation. If they can't oppose every policy, what's the next best move, she asked. It's to place yourself in the driver's seat, and that is what every single one of them is doing. Some research has stoked fear among workers that if their jobs aren't replaced, work will become more demanding and intense. One study looking at a sample of workers showed that AI adoption, rather than freeing workers to focus on the more creative aspects of their jobs, led them to double the time they spent on things like email and business management tools. Time spent on focused, concentrated work fell. Political operators such as Steve Bannon and investors including Vinod Khosla have issued warnings about AI's rising popularity and urged companies to take steps to brighten what has become a dystopian societal conversation about the technology. OpenAI recently went as far as purchasing the podcast TBPN, which is known in part for its tech booster vibe. The podcast, which will fall under Lehane, a veteran political communicator, aligns with what appears to be a broader effort by tech companies to shape the narrative around AI. AI's rising unpopularity has the potential to stymie the growth of the AI boom, especially since continued growth will rely on a vast build-out of computing data centers all over the world. Some local officials and activists have begun to push back on data center plans, objecting to the threat of utility cost increases and job losses. Major market disruptions, like the $1.6 trillion meltdown that hit software stocks earlier this year, could prove dangerous if they hit swaths of customers that the big AI companies are relying on to help make big investments possible. Anthropic has been perhaps the most vocal company about the need to study and stave off potentially negative impacts of artificial intelligence. The company's societal impacts team has published research on topics like how professionals use AI, and Anthropic recently started an in-house think tank to consider issues such as AI's impact on jobs or its threat to social cohesion. Anthropic and OpenAI have been striking deals with consultants to help promote the use of their technology, turning an army of workers at risk of disruption into evangelists. Anthropic is expanding its team of applied AI engineers who can embed within organizations to help improve productivity with AI. The company is also focused on providing training programs to third-party consulting companies that can do similar work, said Paul Smith, Anthropic's chief commercial officer. The company wants to backstop an ecosystem of people out there, Smith said in an interview with the journal. You're going to see us investing a lot more in things like training and certifications, in which they can attest that someone in a partner organization can help a bank or other company make better use of AI tools, he said. 55% of Americans believe AI will bring more harm than good. Delta warns of higher fares as fuel costs keep climbing, but CEO says travel demand remains healthy across both leisure and business. Delta Airlines message to travelers: prepare for higher fares and fewer flights as it faces rising fuel costs. The biggest U.S. carrier by market capitalization on Wednesday reported its first quarterly loss in nearly 3 years after its fuel expenses rose $330 million and the values of companies it has a stake in dropped. In the current quarter, Delta projected its fuel expense will soar $2 billion from a year ago. Jet fuel prices have surged as conflicts in the Middle East have tightened supplies of crude oil. So far, price increases haven't stopped consumers from booking flights, Delta executives said. Revenue is projected to grow at least 10% this quarter. Demand remains strong across all geographies for both business and leisure travel, said Chief Executive Ed Bastien. It's a healthy travel time, he said. Shares ended the trading day up almost 4%. Other airline stocks, including United, Southwest, and American Airlines, posted even bigger gains. Delta is the first major U.S. carrier to report quarterly results, and analysts are watching the resilience of travel demand and company finances as the Iran war carries on. The biggest concern for the year ahead will be how long jet fuel prices remain elevated, Bastien said. Oil prices dropped sharply after President Trump said he had agreed to a ceasefire if the Strait of Hormuz reopened immediately, offering some relief. We woke up this morning with a very different set of fuel assumptions than we had when we went to bed, Bastien told analysts. Delta swung to a first quarter loss of $289 million, or 44 cents a share. But stripping out one-time items, adjusted earnings hit 64 cents a share, which was stronger than analysts expected. Adjusted operating revenue rose 9% to $14.2 billion, a better-than-expected result compared with forecasts. Executives said the airline has room to increase fares and fees. On Tuesday, it joined JetBlue Airways and United in boosting fees on checked bags for domestic travel and other routes with some exceptions. Delta's more affluent customers are also showing no signs of slowing their spending, Bestine said. They are resilient, they are prioritizing experiences, and they're wanting to travel, he said. Hutchinson begins Maersk arbitration over ports. CK Hutchinson has started arbitration against A.P. Moller Maersk after Panama seized its port assets in the country. The move escalates a dispute that began in January when a Panamanian court voided CK Hutchinson's contracts to run two terminals at either end of the Panama Canal. The company, founded by Hong Kong billionaire Li Ka-shing, has also filed claims against the Panamanian government. Hutchinson Unit Panama Ports Company said Tuesday it had filed the arbitration against Maersk, accusing it of undermining a long-term contract. The arbitration is separate from Hutchinson's case against Panama and will be heard in London. The unit said Maersk was aligned with the Republic of Panama against it, and the plan to replace it through a takeover that installed new port operators. Maersk does not believe it is liable for the claims and will address them in the appropriate forum. We have no further comment at this time, the shipper said. Hutchinson has been in dispute over the concessions since Panama's Supreme Court ruled its port operations unconstitutional. Set against rising China-U.S. tensions, the ruling was seen as a win for the Trump administration's efforts to curb China's influence in the Western Hemisphere. China's Office of Hong Kong Affairs said that the Supreme Court ruling was unfounded, unreasonable, and absurd, noting that Hutchinson's contract had been in force for nearly 30 years. In a recent earnings report, Hutchinson said the issue has complicated talks over a potential sale of stakes in certain port assets. The company had planned to sell the two contested ports as part of a $23 billion deal to a group that includes BlackRock. Analysts said the financial impact was limited, noting the ports contributed little to earnings. Shares closed 3.9% higher in Hong Kong on Wednesday, taking year-to-date gains to around 19%. Shell sees gas output hit trading boost amid war. Shell cut its outlook for the first quarter natural gas production, but said it expected a boost from oil trading as the energy industry counts the costs of the damage caused by the war in the Middle East. The UK energy giant said Wednesday that the output of its integrated gas segment would take a hit from lost Qatari volumes because of the conflict in the first quarter, but that its oil trading operations would deliver a significantly higher result than in the prior quarter. The update from Shell comes after the war in the Middle East set off a volatile ride in energy markets and placed some of the oil and gas industry's biggest investments on the firing line. One of Shell's crown jewel assets, the Pearl Gas to Liquids facility in Qatar, was targeted in the conflict. Shares of oil companies have rallied since the U.S. and Israel began bombing Iran, and Tehran retaliated by blockading the Strait of Hormuz and attacking its neighbors as crude prices surged past $100 a barrel to hit levels last seen in 2022 in the wake of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Oil futures fell back below $100 a barrel after President Trump said Tuesday that he had agreed to a two-week ceasefire with Iran, which said it would reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Shares of Shell fell 4.2% in Amsterdam as oil stocks followed crude prices lower. Ahead of the agreement announcement, some analysts had said that oil prices would likely remain higher than before the conflict broke out, even under a ceasefire, as the war caused damage to energy infrastructure that might take years to repair and disrupted energy flows. Shell said it expected first quarter output in its integrated gas segment to range from 880,000 to 920,000 barrels of oil equivalent a day, against its prior guidance of between 920 and 980,000 barrels of oil equivalent a day. For the fourth quarter, the business produced 948,000 barrels of oil equivalent a day. The company last month said the Pearl facility, the largest in the world that turns gas into liquid petroleum products, was hit by an Iranian attack. Shell narrowed its outlook for first quarter liquefied natural gas volumes to between 7.6 million and 8 million metric tons from 7.4 million to 8 million tons previously. This reflects the ramp-up of LNG Canada that was partly offset by Australia weather constraints and Qatar LNG outages, it said. On the other hand, the company forecasts oil trading for the first quarter to be significantly higher than in the previous quarter. Energy companies trading businesses tend to benefit from market volatility. As long-term LNG contracts usually have a pricing lag, gas trading is expected to be in line with last year's fourth quarter, Shell said. Shell said the impact of unprecedented volatility in commodity prices on inventory would lead to a working capital outflow of between $10 billion and $15 billion in the first quarter, which compares with an inflow of $1.3 billion the prior quarter. Non-cash net debt is expected to include an increase of between $3 billion and $4 billion in variable components of long-term shipping leases, it said. The update shows the resilience of Shell's operations outside of the Qatari outage, and investors will likely look through a monster working capital build, which highlights how unprecedented the current environment is, RBC Capital Markets analysts wrote in a note to clients. Humans are losing the fight against these high-flying fish. Asian carp have been crashing into boaters, doling out black eyes and broken noses. Clint Carter was enjoying the sunshine and gentle rocking of the boat when a 30-pound fish leapt out of the Louisiana water and smashed into his chest. The fisherman was bruised but not particularly surprised. It wasn't his first encounter with a beast that has become the heartland's most vicious invader. Asian carp have taken over the Mississippi River and dozens of tributaries where they have menaced native fish by eating much of their food. They've also spent years terrorizing locals by leaping from the waves and crashing into boaters, water skiers, and fishermen. "I've had them hit me in the arms and legs," said Carter, who recalls one bone bruise on his shin that took weeks to heal. On one outing near Carter's home in central Illinois, a flying carp knocked his friend out cold. "It actually hit him between the eyes, dropped him to his knees," he recalls. Another friend had his nose broken. YouTube is awash with videos of freaked-out Midwesterners batting the meaty fish from their boats. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, the carp can jump as high as 10 feet into the air when spooked by outboard motors or other disturbances. Politicians in Michigan and Illinois are pushing for help to build barriers and blast annoying sounds to repel the fish. Meanwhile, boaters are taking matters into their own hands. When Nate Wallach takes his kids tubing on the Illinois River near his home in Peoria, he makes them wear football helmets. He's also built a cage around the front of their inner tube and gives everyone nets to catch the carp. Videos he's posted show them howling with laughter while dozens of fat fish jump all around them. Wallach wears a helmet and a cup when he goes water skiing, after once taking a hit to the groin that knocked him off his skis. The firefighter has a side business taking tourists bow fishing for the carp along the Illinois River, where he rigs nets around the boat for protection. He once neglected to put his nets up when he was driving his boat alone. "I took one right in the side of the head," he said. "The fish darn near knocked me out." Asian carp originated in China and Russia and were brought to the U.S. in the 1970s to control algae blooms in ponds and wastewater treatment plants. Flooding allowed the fish to escape into the Mississippi Basin and to reproduce at rates that have overpowered native species. The big worry now is that the carp are migrating closer to the Great Lakes, where they could endanger the walleye, bass, and trout that support the region's $5 billion fishing industry. When Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer visited the White House last month to speak with President Trump, she urged the administration to unfreeze federal funding for a river barrier that could stop the fish from reaching Lake Michigan. In a social media post after their meeting, Trump said he was working with Whitmer on trying to save the Great Lakes from the rather violent and destructive Asian carp. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker has also pushed the government to release the funding, saying the fish pose an existential threat to the Great Lakes. The barrier would combine a system of locks with an electric shield to stun and repel the fish. Underwater speakers blasting irritating sounds and a curtain of air bubbles would also deter the carp. For now, alternative control measures continue apace. At the Redneck Fishing Tournament in Bath, Illinois, contestants use nets to catch as many jumping carp as they can. Some wear helmets, and a few have left with black eyes or broken noses, says founder Betty DeFord. She started the tournament to combat the fish after getting smacked by a carp while driving a pontoon boat 20 years ago. "I had a bruised shoulder and almost a black eye from it, and I thought, well, this is on." Carter started fishing for the carp full-time, lured by subsidies from the state of Illinois, which pays a dime per pound. Illinois is also trying to get more people to eat them. The State Department of Natural Resources has undertaken a marketing push to rebrand the fish as copi, short for copious, to distinguish them from the bottom-feeding common carp and make them sound more appetizing. Fishermen and chefs report that Asian carp are actually delicious, though they are so bony they don't make good fillets. Chefs often grind them up and turn them into fish cakes. Illinois officials have handed out samples of copi cakes at the state fair and set up a website, Choose Copi, to encourage restaurants, fishmongers, and consumers to embrace the fish. In Baton Rouge, Louisiana, the French chef Philippe Parola has become a passionate advocate for copi. He includes some carp recipes in his Can't Beat 'em, Eat 'em cookbook and wants to start a business to sell frozen copi croquettes. Parola says he has taken his fair share of carp hits over the years, but never to the head. During a group fishing trip, one of Parola's friends, Aaron Pierce, got smacked in the back by a flying carp, leaving a giant fish print on his t-shirt. "This was a 35-pound fish," Parola said. "The guys were all laughing about it, but it could have broken someone's back." The sea and neighbors are angry on Nantucket. A vandal is at large on Nantucket, an island better known for gray shingle cottages, boat shoes, and billionaires. In January, someone apparently slashed a 947-foot-long structure of sand-filled tubes designed to slow erosion of scenic Sconset Bluff. The damage to the project, on which homeowners spent about $18 million and could cost another $2 million to repair, has inflamed a battle between people trying to save expensive summer homes teetering on the bluff's edge and year-rounders who have said nature should take its course. It's shocking, said Josh Posner, president of the Sconset Beach Preservation Fund. The group is trying to protect 80 houses on Baxter Road, an enclave with spectacular ocean views and named properties such as Owl's Nest. Members of the Hearst and Soros families own homes there, along with legendary commodities trader Helmut Weimer and Amos Hostetler, a Boston-based billionaire and philanthropist. Erosion fights are raging on coastlines nationwide as sea level rise and intense storms devour beaches and prime real estate. Few have been as entrenched as Nantucket's. The dispute involves lawsuits, testy town meetings, and talk of class conflicts. Lifelong friends now find themselves on opposing sides, with one faction even accusing the other side of engineering a political purge of the island's Conservation Commission. And now, ahead of a May town meeting that could decide whether the homeowners can expand the GeoTubes project to protect more homes, someone or something has struck. The Nantucket Police Department, which launched a probe, is considering all possibilities, including Mother Nature. The Baxter Road Group hired former Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis to investigate cuts to the sturdy fabric tubes. His verdict? This was in no way an accident or the result of natural forces. The homeowners are offering a $10,000 reward to flush out the culprit. It's a small island, Posner said, and it seems highly unlikely that whoever did this hasn't spoken to anyone else. For centuries, the ocean has threatened to swallow Nantucket, a pork chop-shaped island 30 miles off Massachusetts. Sconset, short for Sea Sconset, faces the Atlantic like the bow of a ship lashed by winter storms. Erosion has already forced homes to be demolished or moved back over the years. For decades, the Baxter Road owners proposed various defenses to delay the inevitable, from a rock wall to dumping dredged sand, a plan rejected by fishermen. In 2013, the homeowners finally won approval to install geotubes on an emergency basis after a severe storm. The structures divided the island from the start. Everyone is mad at us, the quote-unquote rich people on Baxter Road, said William Cohen, a journalist and former banker. He bought his summer cottage, House of Cards, about 17 years ago for $600,000, and since then spent about the same amount to move it 75 feet inland. Now, the Baxter Road Group wants to add 3,000 more feet of geotubes to safeguard more properties. Though a town body approved the expansion last March, a Nantucket bylaw requires residents to approve use of town-owned land for erosion control projects at the annual town meeting. Some opponents of the geotubes have said they increase erosion on other parts of the island. That critical May 4th meeting, where hundreds will gather at the high school to hash out island business, could determine the geotubes' future. Sconset homeowners argue that they are saving the town tens of millions of dollars by protecting Baxter Road itself. If the road is condemned, taxpayers could be on the hook for a new one, plus utilities. Property values along Baxter Road are already falling, and oceanfront homes account for a hefty portion of the island's tax base. It is absolutely crazy that the town has resisted an effort by individual homeowners to protect their property and the road and public utilities with a technology that is now proven, said Weimar, who is 89 and spends much of his time in Princeton, New Jersey. He visited the island in 1958, skipping his Massachusetts Institute of Technology graduation ceremony to join his wife, who summered there growing up. In the late 1980s, they bought a decades-old Sconset house named Twin Chimney. No one has pushed harder than Weimar to slow the erosion. He now envisions a future with a rock barrier at the base of the bluff, something opponents hate more than geotubes. I see this as a small number of very wealthy, really influential people who will not take no for an answer, said D. Ann Atherton, a year-round resident. She lives in Squam, a Nantucket village reachable by an unpaved road, and helped to found the Nantucket Coastal Conservancy, in part to fight the geotubes. She and others contend the geotubes were originally approved as a temporary fix. Their chief objection? They might protect Sconset, but speed up erosion to the north by disrupting the natural movement of sand around the island. That has been exacerbated, she said, by homeowners' failure to comply with terms of the original permit, which required them to provide sand to cover the geotubes, sand that would naturally erode and nourish other beaches. Posner said the Baxter Road Group spent $13 million on so-called mitigation sand, but the homeowners admit they stopped providing the required amounts in 2021, 2 years after the Town Conservation Commission rejected the geotube expansion. The newly constituted commission approved it last year. Robert Greenhill, who owns a compound on nearly a mile of shoreline north of Sconset, is appealing that approval. He alleges the geotubes have accelerated erosion on his property, costing him more than 2 acres of beachfront. Baxter Road homeowners, armed with their own experts, dispute this. Tension has grown. Residents on Quindet and Squam bought a full-page newspaper ad to protest the geotubes. Hostetter's main house, Owl's Nest, has lost about 200 feet of dunes. A geotube supporter, he owns two other homes, including a guest house, where John Steinbeck, who wrote much of East of Eden in Sconset, once etched his name on a window pane. Asked why opposition has been so strong, Weimar said, I think there may be a bit of class warfare going on. Jobs market confounds prognosticators. Wall Street experts have had big misses as they adjust to more volatility. If it feels like economists have been slumping lately, it's not just your imagination. With 3 chances so far in 2026 to project monthly job creation, Wall Street's soothsayers have struck out. To be fair, they have been thrown some major curveballs. In a fast-changing labor market, the Trump administration's immigration crackdown has cut population growth, downshifting job creation to a trend that can land on either side of zero in any given month. Strikes and bad weather have caused labor market hiccups this year, and technical changes have made official calculations less predictable than they used to be. I don't think forecasting the headline labor market numbers has been this challenging at any point in my career, said Jonathan Pingle, a UBS economist. In January, forecasters' consensus vastly undershot the net gain of 130,000 jobs that the Labor Department initially reported. Then, in February, with economists expecting further steady gains, they were wrong-footed by sharp job losses, which partially reflected bad weather and a big health care strike. March brought another whiff when forecasters were counting on moderate job gains and wound up blindsided by a blowout increase. This yields a yawning gap of 112,000 monthly jobs, on average, between what the Labor Department first reported and analysis projections so far this year. The Wall Street Journal analyzed the projections it collects each month against the first Labor Department jobs report before revisions that alter numbers later. Pingle's UBS team did quite a bit better than most on the March data, estimating that 100,000 new jobs were created versus the Wall Street consensus of 59,000. but he still underestimated the actual tally by some 78,000 jobs. Still, this doesn't mean Wall Street has suddenly lost the plot. Analysts averaged a monthly miss of roughly 38,100 jobs in 2025, the data show. Better than average misses, nearly $75,000 a month a year before. The challenge increases when the economy is changing rapidly. In 2020, when companies were shedding jobs in an escalating pandemic, projections were often sharply off. Nailing economic forecasts can be high stakes for financial industry economists. When official government numbers land, stock and bond prices instantly adjust to new clues about not only how the economy is doing, but how the Federal Reserve is likely to respond. Making your mark in this game is a subtle art, said Robert Barbera, a Johns Hopkins University economics professor who spent decades making predictions on Wall Street. Publishing a forecast that differs significantly from competitors amounts to throwing your weight behind a strong trading recommendation, so many economists hesitate to go out on a limb. If I go out there and say that the next three payroll numbers are going to be minus 100,000, I'm effectively saying you've got to own the 10-year or you're stupid, Barbera said, referring to 10-year Treasury notes, which often rally as the economy slows. It is often more comfortable to make moderate forecasts projecting that recent trends will continue, even if that risks the occasional big miss, he said. The past few months have brought the type of volatility that makes those misses more common. And that's it for today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Ken, your volunteer reader here at the Talking Information Center, and I thank you for listening.